Dead. Joan Crawford. New York City, May 10th, 1977. Official cause of death, coronary arrest. It was dawn when my husband David and I landed in New York. My brother Chris arrived at the hotel about 10:30. He looked older and much thinner. Hard times and trouble were so clearly evident that he may as well have been carrying a sign. We held each other in greeting and consolation and a kind of understanding that went back 30 years deep into childhood. "I'm really glad you're here," is all I said. It was very tough for him. Chris hadn't been included in any family events since he was 15 years old. At noon, the three of us took a taxi to the Drake Hotel. There we were to meet the lawyer, the secretary, and one sister, Kathy, with her husband. The greetings were strained. Everyone was being polite, but there were other feelings beneath all that niceness. Nothing had been written down before Mother's death regarding the funeral arrangements except that she wanted to be cremated. I thought it was odd that someone so fanatically well organized should have left these details to anyone else. Never in any of our past experiences had we decided anything in relation to her, except how we would each live our lives. As the hours dragged on, it became painfully clear what some of those life decisions had been. Then, during one of the many phone calls to Campbell's funeral home, a strange expression came over the lawyer's face as he listened to the voice on the other end of the line. "Your mother has been embalmed. You may see her if you want to." He said it straight and without emphasis. The funeral home on 81st Street was just what you would imagine it to be. There was a muffled quality to everything. I was beginning to feel very tired and a little sick to my stomach. I held on to David's hand whenever I could. A man from Campbell's asked who would like to see Mother. For the first time, a complete silence surrounded all of us. It was almost as though no one could even breathe. Kathy said no. Cindy shook her head no. Chris swallowed hard and looked quite pale. He said no. I said, "I'd like to see her." He started telling me how beautiful she looked, and his own face was quite radiant as he described how hard he'd worked from some of his favorite photographs of her. I realized in a strange flash of understanding that for a moment he'd thought that no one would see what he'd done, that no one would be there to appreciate his work of art. I stared at him in genuine fascination. The little elevator stopped on the second floor. At the end of the hall, there was a large room. I looked straight ahead with a terrible fright. There she was, not 10 feet away from me, lying on a table, dead. "May I be alone, please?" I whispered. My knees felt weak and my hands were shaking. I heard the man walk down the hallway. "That's my mother on that table, and she's really dead." Somehow, I absolutely had to know that. Somehow, I had to take this terrifying time alone to make that real, to know for myself that death was real, even if much of life hadn't been. To make sure of that reality, I gave myself this time alone with her at the very end so that I could go on. It was a very fragile feeling. I was scared, really scared. Scared beyond anything I'd ever known before. I didn't know what to do. I was still standing at the doorway to the room. I hadn't moved. This was my time. I didn't have to worry about keeping anyone waiting or what anyone else thought. It was just the two of us, Mother and me, alone, for the very last time. An incredible wave of sadness washed over me. My mouth was trembling and my eyes filled with tears that hadn't yet fallen free. I swallowed a couple of times and I heard myself say, "Mommy, oh, Mommy, I loved you so much." The tears inched down my face and I wiped a few away. I walked up to the table and stood next to her. Her eyes were closed. They had done a good job with the makeup. Her face looked quite natural, surprisingly so. As I looked carefully at her, almost inch by inch, I noticed how terribly thin she was. In truth, she had wasted away to nothing, to skin and bones. It dawned on me in that moment that coronary arrest was not the whole story, not the whole story at all. It takes a long time to become that thin. There was hardly anything left to her at all. But her face was indeed her face, and I looked at her a long time. I had never seen a dead person before. At any moment, I expected her to open her eyes and say, "Tina?" For a split second, I even wondered if she'd scold me or have something to say about the way I was dressed. As I stood before my mother for this last time, I realized there could be no further exchange between us. Throughout all our years together, I was never absolutely sure of the reception I was going to get from her. I never knew whether it would be a big hug of loving affection or a slap in the face. Though I felt no trace of guilt or regret about our long and turbulent relationship, I did feel an enormous surge of loneliness that this silence was the end of it all. I had not seen her in several years, but I had imagined that we might have one last talk, that somehow she might know before the end of her life who this eldest daughter of hers really was, and perhaps even take some measure of pride in what had evolved out of our chaotic relationship. I remembered how she'd insisted that I make an appointment to see her, even when we were together every day. I looked down at this painfully thin woman with sadness, thinking of the way she'd regimented her life in order to avoid really living it. She'd become so afraid of spontaneity, of anything she couldn't directly control.
This upload presented by the concluding chapter of Crawford.
Now I had an overwhelming need to feel her strong embrace remembered from the far reaches of my childhood, just one last time. Instead, I reached over and touched her hand. It was cold. Mother had very strong hands and prided herself on a straightforward handshake. Her hands were now very thin, her wrists little more than bones. I don't know how long I stood there thinking about her, about me, about the two of us locked in a duel of wits and will all these years. I was her first child, her precious, beautiful princess of a daughter, the golden-haired baby she wanted so much. Maybe it was a stroke of eternal justice that I should have the courage to be the last, to be with her in death for a while. This final appointment with my mother was one she had not made and she could not change. "I know you're not really here with me anymore, Mother. I know your soul is gone already. I just want to tell you that I love you, that I forgive you. You know I forgave you long ago. We had so much pain together, but now, Mother, God has set us both free. God has set you free to begin another journey. I pray the next one has less anguish. God has set us free, Mommy dearest. Go in peace." I could hear the sobs now. They were mine. I leaned over and kissed her forehead gently. "Goodbye, Mother. Goodbye. And I love you." I wiped my face with the back of my hand and put on my dark glasses. Then I turned and left her. Billy Casson, or Lucille Lesueur, arrived in Hollywood in January 1925 as one of the lucky newcomers. She already had a signed MGM contract. She made close friends with the studio publicity department, posing for every outlandish publicity gimmick. She made herself available on a moment's notice at a time when the big female stars on the Metro lot were becoming increasingly disenchanted with the insatiable publicity mill, even refusing to sit for any still pictures. That publicity churned out month after month, created a national excitement about the young starlet Lucille Lesueur before she'd been given an opportunity to display her acting skills to any extent in a movie. The unsung heroes of her career were the nameless troops of the MGM publicity department. Many of them devoted their lives to creating the fabulous fantasies of stardom for the rest of the world. Mother never forgot her allegiance to them, As one elderly publicist said after her death, she had four marriages which lasted only 3 years each, but I've loved her for more than 40 years. She became Joan Crawford a year later through a movie magazine Name the Star contest sponsored by MGM. She hated her new name. She said that Crawford sounded like crawfish. It was 1926. She diligently began putting this new creature called Joan Crawford together as a total movie star. Every facet of her being was remodeled, leaving the mannerisms and physical appearance of Lucille LeSeur behind. From 1925 to 1928, she appeared in over 20 films. But it wasn't until Our Dancing Daughters, which was released in 1928, that she finally tasted stardom. A year later, she married the Prince of Pickfair, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. The columnists acknowledged the union with mixed reviews. It was no secret in Hollywood that Joan Crawford was already an accomplished social climber. The wedding did not have the approval of Douglas Fairbanks Sr. or of stepmother Mary Pickford, but the young couple was married anyway in the rectory of a Catholic church, according to the wishes of the bride, who considered herself a Catholic. This was a time of major transition for Joan Crawford. Her dreams were all coming true. Behind her were the days of struggle. Ahead were the unlimited horizons of wealth and stardom. She had a new name, a new husband, a whole new world. She was the American dream. The remake of Rain with Sound, which was released in 1932, was a dismal failure. In her portrayal, she had allowed herself a sort of nakedness and vulnerability. Simultaneously, the newspaper columns and movie magazines reported that the Fairbanks marriage was saddened by a miscarriage. However, years later, Joan Crawford was bitterly outspoken and told at least one close friend that she'd really had an abortion. Whether abortion or miscarriage, the results were the same. There were neither children nor grandchildren from this marriage, and it ended in the spring of 1933. After her marriage to Fairbanks failed, she devoted herself to her career and to her first love affair with Clark Gable. In Gable, she'd found her match. He was a man big enough, charming enough, and strong enough to deal with her spirit, her drive, and her ambition. But he was also a married man, and any permanent liaison was impossible. Then in October of 1935, she remarried. This time, it was to Franchot Tone. Franchot was the epitome of the cultured, well-educated gentleman. His family tree went all the way back to the American Revolution, and he had ancestors who were master silversmiths, rivaling Paul Revere. Not only did he have breeding, impeccable taste, and a respected family, he was also an intellectual and considered an actor's actor. They made several films together before and after they were married, but Franchot never became a real Hollywood movie star. She and Franchot lived in her Brentwood house. It was during the years of this marriage that Mother became a wine connoisseur and learned about gourmet foods. Franchot taught her to appreciate fine art and classic literature. The jazz baby turned slick, sophisticated movie star was finally becoming a lady. She was a big star when she married Franchot, and he was considered just a leading man. He constantly lived in the shadow of her stardom, even though he was a well-known and respected actor. Her last big box office year was 1936. She knew the pictures Metro assigned her were getting progressively more shallow and less successful with the public. She was fighting for her professional life. This marriage had not produced any children either, and when she actually caught Franchot having an affair with another woman, she threw him out of her house. The divorce was final in April of 1939. If her marriage to Fairbanks can be said to have given her a mark of acceptance and respectability, the marriage to Franchot gave her culture and elegance. She still read the funny papers and liked cookies with butter on them, but she was, at long last, a lady. Mother found herself alone again in a huge, empty 22-room house after two unsuccessful marriages, numerous attempts to have children, and 14 years in pictures. And she wasn't getting any younger. Publicly, her birth date was reported as March 23, 1908, but grandmother told me that she was actually born in 1904. That made her closer to 35 in 1939 when I was delivered to her. My official papers simply say girl, born on Sunday afternoon, June 11, 1939. I traveled from Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital to a baby broker to 426 North Bristol Avenue. Only a few weeks old, and I was to be Joan Crawford, Jr., an awesome responsibility. Mother and I were absolutely inseparable. She took me with her wherever she went. I slept in her dressing rooms and on the studio sound stages. She saved every bit of hair cut from my head, every tooth from my mouth. During the months of my infancy, she showered me with the pent-up outpouring of love and affection that had been stifled in her for so many years. She didn't have to share me with anyone. I was hers alone. She was my mommy dearest, the wellspring from whence all love and affection flowed, and I was her longed-for golden-haired girl. She named me after herself, and through the lavish affection, attention, and adornment she showered upon me, she made up for some of the poverty of her own childhood. I was to be the best, the most beautiful, the smartest, quickest, most special child on the face of the earth. We traveled extensively the first year of my life. When I was just 3 months old, Mother took me to New York with her on the train. She kept an apartment in the city near the East River, and every day my nurse, Aunt Kitty, took me for a stroll in my baby carriage. Then, in May 1940, Mommy drove with me to Las Vegas, Nevada, where she legally adopted me. The laws of the state of California did not then permit a single woman to adopt children, so I was 11 months old before my mother made these arrangements in Las Vegas. At some point before the final papers were signed, she had come to the conclusion that Joan Crawford, Jr. was not exactly fitting. She chose a new name for me, and the adoption papers recorded that name as Christina Crawford. Strange Cargo and Susan and God had both been released in 1940. In Strange Cargo, my mother was teamed with Clark Gable. She once said that Gable was only interested in women who weren't available. As much as she yearned for and was attracted to strong men, deep down inside, she only wanted men she could dominate. That definitely was not Clark Gable. Gable had a spirit and a verve for living that set him apart. Although their love affair was relatively brief, Mommy spoke of Gable with a special fondness and respect for the rest of her life. During 1941 and 1942, she made two pictures a year under her Metro contract. But she knew that her career was in serious trouble. Finding herself a has-been at the age of about 37 was a shock. Having to leave her home at MGM was a bereavement. She was never quite the same again. The damage to her public image when she was labeled box office poison didn't hurt her nearly so much as the humiliation she felt at being deserted by the people she had loved and trusted. During all the years, there was never enough success, never enough money or fame or love to fill the void. She seemed to carry the pain in a secret place where nothing ever really touched it. No amount of loving ever erased it. She developed a belligerence about life, an assumption that people were destined to betray her. It was during these years that she began to drink. Finally, after 17 years under contract to MGM, Joan Crawford left and signed with Warner Brothers Studios for less money than she'd been making at Metro. With the exception of Hollywood Canteen, a lavish war effort propaganda movie featuring every star on the Warner's payroll, she went on suspension and didn't work at all for nearly 3 years. Philip Terry was a handsome but relatively unknown actor when she married him in 1942. In 1943, Joan and Philip together decided to adopt a baby boy, whom they called Philip Terry Jr. He looked like a big doll with his blue eyes and blonde curls. From the night he arrived until we left home as teenagers, my brother and I shared a bedroom. The door to our room was always left open, and the hall light burned all night because I was afraid of the dark. When I was about 4, I started having the same dream over and over. I'd been kidnapped by a band of men on horses. Mommy was trying to find me. The horses and the men would stop to rest. I could hear Mommy. She was coming to rescue me, but just as I could actually see her, the men would scoop me up and ride off. I had not made up the entire kidnap terror. Only a few years before I was born, the Lindbergh kidnapping had been a national tragedy. Then, too, before this new baby brother arrived, there had been another one. His name was also Christopher, and he hadn't been with us very long before his real mother came to our house and wanted him back. It was a terrible scene. After they were married, Philip was given the job of disciplining me and administering my spankings. Up until that time, Mommy had been using the hairbrush or her hand. She'd succeeded in breaking 3 hairbrushes across my bottom after complaining that she'd already worn out her hand. I was about 4 or 5. Mommy insisted that each of us learn to swim at an early age. At 4, I could swim quite well, and I was eager to show off to my mother. She decided we should have a race. The first race was only the width of the pool, and she let me win it. After that, I wanted to race again. This time, it was to be the entire length of the pool. We raced several times. She beat me easily. I was furious with her. I swam over to the steps and climbed out of the pool. Dripping wet, I stood looking down at her and said, "You don't play fair. I'm never going to play with you again as long as I live." I remember that my mother laughed. She said, "Christina, I could have won all the time. I'm bigger than you are. I'm faster than you are. I can win all the time."
This upload presented by the concluding chapter of Crawford.
I was only 4 when this brief clash of wills occurred, but I know that neither one of us ever forgot it. Maybe she'd already succeeded in making me as much of a fighter as she was. Maybe this was the very first indication of independence and the baby mutiny that was to enrage her so during the following years. But there was probably no way for either of us to know in that particular moment that this brief exchange was actually setting the stage for our future relationship lasting more than 30 years. My first birthday was celebrated quietly in New York City. It was my second birthday in Brentwood that initiated Mommy's extravaganzas for me. She invited 15 children. She had a full merry-go-round set up on the badminton court in our backyard. In addition to the usual children's games, she provided a clown to entertain us. I vividly remembered that I was absolutely terrified of that clown. When he came near me, I screamed and ran to my mother for protection. I guess everyone else just loved him. The party on my 3rd birthday was even more elaborate than the preceding year's party. Mommy invited 20 children. We had the merry-go-round and the clown again, but this year a complete puppet show was added, and for some inexplicable reason she'd even found a trained pig. But it was my 4th birthday party in June of 1943 that was the grandest spectacle of them all. It was a private circus, a miniature Disneyland before one ever existed for the public. There were balloons everywhere, and music filled the entire backyard. There were several brightly colored clowns, an organ grinder and his monkey, who was in an adorable costume with a little red hat on his head. There were ponies to ride around the lawn, and I loved the pretty ponies best of all. There was also a magician who put on a wonderful magic show in a little portable theater. If this was a gathering of the progeny of Hollywood's royalty, then I was the crown princess. I was the perfect child in every respect. Mommy had created me in the image of perfection and then created these birthday parties to celebrate another successful year of happiness with that creation. The luncheon feast this year was held again in our formal dining room. These little children sat at the long table without any smiles on their faces because they were on their best behavior. We had little pointed hats on our heads like so many dunces. I didn't know most of the children who were invited to my parties. I often felt left out of the games and festivities because I was quite shy. Today, I cannot remember the names of most of the 20 children in the picture of my birthday party luncheon. It was during those parties that I had my first memorable feelings of loneliness. It was my party. I was dressed up in organdy, lace, and satin, feeling vaguely out of place. Several days before my fourth birthday, a Scottish lady named Mrs. Howe came to take care of my infant brother and me. It was Mrs. Howe who taught me to skip rope and ride a bicycle. I loved pretend games and could play them for hours, sometimes alternating between two and three characters at one time. I had to take a nap every day, but sometimes I wasn't sleepy. I made up stories that had elaborate plots and running characters. I continued the stories from one day to another, just like a serial. My bed was up against the wall, and as I daydreamed, I ran my finger over a seam in the wallpaper. Before I knew it, several little pieces of the wallpaper had fallen away. I spit on the torn pieces and tried to patch the spot. It didn't work. Where the wallpaper had gotten wet, there were now smudge marks. The whole thing looked worse than if I'd left it alone. At about this time, Mrs. Howe came in to get me up. When she saw what I'd done, she slapped my hands and scolded me. I knew she'd have to tell my mother about it. When Mommy came home, she went to my room to see the reported damage for herself. Right then and there, she put me over her knee and spanked the daylights out of me. I howled. But that was not the end of it. She marched herself into my dressing room and opened the closet door. She reached inside and withdrew my favorite dress. Mommy took the scissors and shredded my favorite yellow dress. Tears sprang to my eyes and I started to cry. She told me that I was going to have to wear that shredded thing for 1 week. If anyone asked me why I was wearing a torn dress, I was to reply only, "I don't like pretty things." With that pronouncement, she dropped my dress at my feet and left. That next week seemed interminable. I cried most of the time and kept to myself. I was mortified at my appearance and tried to become invisible. As the days went by, it got dirtier and dirtier until it was nothing but a filthy rag. The material had unraveled, and there wasn't much left to cover me except my underwear. You could hardly tell that it was once yellow. As I struggled through the disintegration of my favorite yellow dress and the humiliation of looking like a street urchin, I wondered if I wouldn't have been better off left in an orphanage. My mother seemed oblivious to my pain. No one comforted me. At the end of the seventh day, I marched myself down to the incinerator and threw the filthy, ragged remains of what had been my favorite yellow dress into the coals and watched as it sank into the soft gray ashes. One day, Philip just didn't come home again. I never even had a chance to say goodbye to him. He was just gone. After Philip left, an amazing thing happened. Within 24 hours, there was not a trace of him left anywhere in the entire house. And in our scrapbooks, Philip's image was ripped out of every picture. Sometimes only his head was ripped off. Other pictures were torn down the middle to remove him completely. One or two of the photos were left with just a severed male hand sticking out beyond the torn part. Except for those mutilated photographs, it was as if he had never existed at all, that he'd just been a figment of my imagination. The lesson indelibly etched on me was that when Mommy Dearest got mad enough, she ripped people to shreds and made them disappear. That thought scared me so much it was like falling into eternal darkness. I spent more than 25 years trying to make sure my Mommy Dearest loved me, trying to win her acceptance and approval so she wouldn't get that mad and make me disappear, too. The first starring role my mother did for Warner's under her new contract was in Mildred Pierce, a picture she made for Jerry Wald. Jerry had to fight the front office to get her the part, and after nearly 3 years without any work at all, she was very nervous when the picture started shooting. During the 3 years she hadn't worked, most of our house had been closed up. For a while, even our big kitchen was closed down, and we cooked over a Sterno stove in the basement. But now in 1945, even though the house seemed emptier without Philip Terry, life was going better for my mother. Unfortunately, the picture couldn't last indefinitely, and the day eventually came when it was finished. At first, only weekends were difficult. We lived according to a rigid and unchanging schedule. We got up every day at the same time, whether it was Monday or Saturday. We ate breakfast at the same time and did the dishes and made our beds right on schedule. The older we got, the more inflexible the schedule became. Right after the war, meat was scarce, and my mother bought it on the black market. She lost no time telling us we were to remember the starving children of Europe and eat every scrap of food on our plates. One night, we were served black market steak. I would eat all the cooked edges of the meat and be left staring at the blood-red center. I could not swallow those pieces because every time I tried to, I gagged. So, at the end of the half-hour mealtime, my plate was removed to the refrigerator to await breakfast. The next morning, I got a glass of milk and that cold plate, which was by now greasy and yucky. I was not allowed to sit down at the table, but had to stand at my place for the entire half hour. I did drink my milk, and that was all. For dinner, I had the same plate cold from the refrigerator, but now I was not allowed at the table. I had to stand and stare at this horrible, grungy plate placed on top of the chest freezer on the back porch. I tried to eat a couple pieces of the wretched meat and ended up vomiting in the toilet. The next morning, I didn't even want to get up. I knew that awful plate was down in the refrigerator waiting for me, and the worst of it was that I was now really getting hungry. 3 glasses of milk were not enough to keep a 9-year-old going for very long. My stomach was growling. I went downstairs thinking that the ordeal just might be over. After all, I was just a kid, and it was 2 full days since I'd been allowed a meal. I marched myself out to the freezer, and there it was. The same plate from 2 days ago. How I hated the sight of it. I felt completely helpless. Why did everybody hate me? It's just unfair. What did I do that was so bad? I hate bloody meat. So what? Everybody hates something.
This upload presented by the concluding chapter of Crawford.
Someone telephoned Mother at the studio to tell her that I wouldn't eat. She yelled at me for being a selfish, ungrateful child. I lay in my bed crying. I wasn't even hungry anymore. I didn't understand why she got so mad at me, why everything I did seemed to make her angry. I thought about running away from home, but I had nowhere to go. There were now 4 children in the Crawford house. When I was 8 years old, my brother and I moved into Mr. Terry's old room, and our former bedroom was redecorated as a nursery. We awaited the arrival of what we were told were twins. They looked adorable, and we were very excited, but they did not look like twins to any of us. Mommy explained all that away by saying they were fraternal rather than identical twins. She had ordered twins from the broker, and twins they were going to be. She named one girl Kathy and one girl Cynthia. The 2 babies were taken up to their nursery and gradually took their place in the family. On Sunday, if she got up in time, we had to go to church. We got dressed and drove to the Christian Science Church in Beverly Hills. If we didn't go to church on Sunday, Mommy would call me into her sitting room after lunch while Chris took his nap. She sat on the couch and I sat on the floor. Together we did the lesson. Christian Science had each Sunday worked out so that you could do the lesson at home. I thought that was very clever. After the lesson was over, my mother would place her regular call to Sorky. I met Sorky only once when I was a very small child. I know that she was the most influential person in Mommy's life. Sorky was a Christian Science practitioner who lived by herself in a small apartment in New York City. My mother was devoted to her. Sorky was a rotund woman and the only fat person my mother ever tolerated. Mother depended on being able to call Sorky at any time of the day or night. Mommy trusted her absolutely, and as I look back, I think she was the only person in the whole world that my mother did trust. Mother also had her doctors, upon whom she relied increasingly as the years went by. It might be an oversimplification to say that later on she became a hypochondriac, but it was something very close to that. There were times when her fetish for cleanliness took possession of her. She took 3 and 4 showers a day and brushed her teeth every few hours. She could not stand to have her hands dirty and would wash them repeatedly. My mother's preoccupation with cleanliness permeated the house we lived in. No sergeant in charge of latrine duty could have done better. When frustration or anxiety or sheer insanity overtook her, she mustered every able-bodied creature within shouting distance and pressed them into service. We were an unlikely crew, always falling far short of her expectations. But the worst of these voyages into cleanomania were what later became known between my brother and myself as the night raids. What was so terrifying about the night raids was that they could not be predicted. They sprang full-blown without warning. We were always asleep, and it was always dark outside when they started. Months would go by without a night raid, and then there it would be, running full speed ahead and already out of control. What mysterious combination of external and internal events led up to my mother's volcanic behavior? I still do not know. What I know is that they were the most dreaded of all the journeys she took us through. I was awakened out of a sound sleep one night by a crashing sound. I opened my eyes, sitting bolt upright in bed. I saw that my closet door was open, the light was on, and various pieces of clothing were flying out into the room. Inside the closet, my mother was in a rage. She was swearing a blue streak and muttering to herself. I dared not move out of my bed. After the closet was totally demolished, Mommy emerged breathless and triumphant. She had a wild look in her eyes. She grabbed me by the hair and dragged me into the closet, which was a complete shambles. Everything was off the shelves. She'd ripped the clothes off their hangers and thrown both clothes and hangers out into the room where they lay sprawled over half the floor. Shaking me by the hair of my head, she screamed in my ear, "No wire hangers! No wire hangers!" With one hand, she pulled me by the hair, and with the other, she pounded my ears until they rang, and I could hardly hear her screaming. When she finished hitting me, she released my hair and dumped me on the floor. Then she ripped my bed apart, throwing the sheets and blankets across the room. She stood in the doorway with her hands on her hips. "Clean up your mess!" she growled, turning on her heel. The only other sound I heard was the double doors to her room slamming shut. It was well past midnight. Chris was still alive in the next bed. Once he was sure that she was gone and not coming back, he turned his body slowly to face me. It was probably the first time he dared to stir since the beginning of the night raid. He couldn't get up because he was tied down to the bed. Mother had a barbaric device she called a sleep safe, with which she made sure Chris could not get out of bed. It was like a harness made out of heavy canvas straps, and it fastened at the back. It was originally designed to keep babies from falling out of bed, but she had the thing modified to accommodate a growing boy. We were forbidden to get out of bed at night to go to the bathroom or to get a drink of water without specific permission. Sometimes we would yell our lungs out and no one would come. There were times when my brother simply had to go to the bathroom, and I would undo the wretched sleep safe and stand guard while he raced to the bathroom and then jumped back into bed. We had it timed like an Indianapolis pit stop because both our lives depended on expert teamwork. I would have gotten in more trouble than Chris if we'd ever been caught. He would have gotten beaten for getting out of bed, but I would have been nearly killed for letting him out of the sleep safe. The day after one of the night raids, all was ominously silent. I don't know if the servants knew about the raids and simply kept their doors locked, or if our room was far enough away that the sound didn't carry to the other side of the house. Generally, Mother didn't speak a word to me for several days after a night raid, and, in fact, I rarely saw her. I was sort of silently banished for a period of time, and then, as mysteriously as it had all materialized, the situation disappeared and life returned to near normal. There was one night raid the whole house heard because it took place in my mother's dressing room with all the doors wide open, and it lasted for a long time. I was about 9 years old. As punishment for some infringement of the rules, my mother had decreed that while she was out for the day, I had to clean her dressing room. It was a large room with mirrored walls over the sink at one end of the room and the glass-topped dressing table at the other. In the middle of that night, one of the most vicious night raids took place. I was sound asleep in my bed when Mother burst into my room. She was already yelling as she hauled me out of bed. Before I was fully awake, she dragged me by one arm down the hallway that connected her rooms with ours. Through the open double doors, I stumbled as she shoved me ahead of her. The best I could gather from my mother's ranting and raving was that the floor had soap streaks in it. Then I made one of my classic mistakes and said that I didn't see anything wrong with the floor. That sent her into a renewed fit of anger. With lightning speed, she backhanded me squarely across the face, which caught me off balance and sent me to the floor. She threw open the door under the sink and grabbed a large can of scouring powder. Just as I got to my feet, she flew at me in a frenzy, wielding the can like a baseball bat. She beat me over the head until the can burst open with a small explosion. A cloud of white scouring powder filled the entire room, settling over every square inch of mirror and glass and linoleum. I had that powder in my hair and all over my nightgown. It was getting into my mouth, and I sputtered and spit it out for fear it would poison me. She was still screaming and beating me with the now mutilated can. By this time, I was yelling back at her to stop hitting me, and the noise must have awakened everyone. Finally, she threw the useless container across the room in total disgust. It looked as though it had been snowing inside these four walls. "Clean it up," she said. "How?" I moaned. "You figure it out," she stormed at me and left. I sat down and a puff of white scouring powder billowed up around me. All I had to work with was a broom, a bucket, a couple of big towels, and a mop. I had to go over every inch of that room four or five times because the scouring powder made a white paste as soon as it got wet, and there was an entire can of it scattered around the room. It was tedious and torturous work. Before I could even begin, I had to wash my own face and neck. The powder stuck to the rest of my body, and as I sweated with the hard work, little rivulets of perspiration coagulated with the powder in white patches that began to itch. Through the whole night, I worked and sobbed. I didn't even care if anyone heard me as I trudged through the process again and again, trying to get the damnable white powder cleaned up. I prayed to God to punish my mother, and told anyone who would listen how much I hated her. Somewhere around 4:30 in the morning, I decided that I could work no longer. I didn't care if she punished me again. I just couldn't do any better. If it wasn't perfect, I couldn't help it. I was only 9 years old, and I couldn't do any more. I truly wished that the earth would open and just swallow me up and take me out of this eternal misery and punishment. I sobbed as I wrung out the mop for the 100th time, and I sobbed as I emptied the dirty water in the bucket. I sobbed as I walked to my room, and I was still crying in the warm shower. It was nearly 5 o'clock in the morning when I wearily climbed back into bed, and still the tears were streaming down. Finally, I just gave up fighting and cried myself to sleep. I don't have any pictures of Grandmother, but I can remember her vividly. Her name was Anna, and she was a small woman with brown hair, sparkly eyes, and a soft voice. She spoke with only a hint of a Southwest accent. She wore simple, dark cotton dresses and plain black shoes. Mother didn't like the way she dressed. She said it was depressing to see all those dark dresses with the little flowers and polka dots. Grandmother could do everything. She made pickles and relish, jams and jellies. She made delicious pies and cakes, and whenever she came to visit us, she always brought our favorites, chocolate pie for my brother and a banana cake for me. She always seemed so pleased with our squeals of delight each time the shower of our hugs and kisses fell upon her. Mother and grandmother didn't get along very well. Grandmother was not included in any holiday festivities. She was not invited to our birthday parties. She never stayed to have lunch or dinner with us, and there were no photographs of her anywhere in the house. Mother was always very sketchy about the details of her own childhood, her relationship with her own family. When she was still a baby, her father deserted. Mother never saw her real father again. She hinted once that she might have been illegitimate, that her mother was not really married the first time, but that may have been more a feeling than a fact. When Grandmother married for the second time, it was to a vaudeville theater manager named Harry Casson, who moved the family to Lawton, Oklahoma. Young Lucille was devoted to this man, who became the only real father she'd known. She called him Daddy Casson and changed her own name to Billy Casson by the time she was just 9. She spent hours sitting backstage with him while he worked, and it was during those days that she decided to become a dancer and go into the theater herself. She was not specific about what happened, but in 1915, when Billy was about 11 years old, her beloved Daddy Casson also deserted the family, and the marriage ended in divorce. This time, the family ended up in Kansas City, Missouri, and was plunged into total poverty. The only work Anna Casson could find was in a laundry. Since she had no money, she made arrangements for herself and the two children to live in one unused room behind the laundry. Anna Casson made arrangements with the Sisters of St. Agnes Convent for her daughter to attend the school on scholarship. Billy was to work a prescribed number of hours each week in return for her room and board. Years later, when Mother told us the story of her years at St. Agnes, it was tinged with a steely anger. She said she hated that school. She also hated her mother for sending her away while keeping her brother, Hal, at home. Her mother married for a third time just as Billy was finishing high school. Mother later implied that this man was only her mother's boyfriend, not her husband, and that he tried to seduce her. Billy took various department store jobs and entered any dance contest she could find. Eventually, she landed a brief chorus job in a Kansas City hotel. From there, she went to Chicago and on to Detroit, where she danced in various clubs. She had changed her professional name back to Lucille Lesur. Then J.J. Schubert saw her and offered her a job in New York in the chorus line of Innocent Eyes. During her few years in New York, she lived in a small walk-up apartment near Broadway and augmented